You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Oh, a pleasure to be back.
So you're sticking with the howdy, huh?
I don't know.
Yeah. That's all right.
For now.
You're allowed to do that because you're from Texas, right?
Exactly.
So this is a very interesting episode this week. We have the Nobel Prize reports coming up, and we're going to review the movie The Martian. But first, I have some very good news. An update on the lawsuit. As I'm sure most of our listeners know, I and the SGU were sued by a physician, Edward Tobinick, for an article I wrote about his treatments on science-based medicine. Last week, the judge ruled on my motion for summary judgment, granting my motion for summary judgment.
What does that mean?
That means the case is over. She basically said that Tobinick cannot possibly win the case as a matter of law, and that therefore... it's over.
You know. Yay!
So he has no merit. He has
it has no,
no
merit, basically. Yeah, and summary judgment, the bar is really high for that. You know, as the judge says in the decision itself, that she has to give all the benefit of the doubt to the person not filing for summary judgment. You know, so anything in question, any doubt gets assumed in his favor. She has to look at the facts in a way that's most favorable to his position. And then even still, she said that his case has no merit. So there's a lot of confusion about exactly what this decision means. I wrote about it on Science-Based Medicine, obviously, and posted on our Facebook page, and the comments are all wonderful, and I appreciate all the support. But it's clear to me from reading the comments that there's a lot of confusion about exactly what happened. And that's understandable because it's complicated. Mm-hmm. So let me unpack it a little bit, just so people understand what happened a little bit better. So first of all, there were multiple defendants in the case. Myself personally, SGU Productions, the Society for Science-Based Medicine, and Yale University. Yale had absolutely nothing to do with this. He just threw them in. And they very quickly extricated themselves from the case. We convinced them, you know, SGU Productions had to get their own lawyer, and we convinced them to drop us from the suit. The Society for Science-Based Medicine got their own lawyer. They also, earlier this year, filed a motion for summary judgment, and they were granted summary judgment as well, which removed them from the case. So I was the last defendant standing in the case.
Well, I had to get a lawyer at one point too.
Well, yeah, because they tried to rope Jay in at one point, and they did depose him, and he had to get his own attorney as well. It's true. There's also multiple plaintiffs in the case. There's Tobinick himself, his California corporation, and his Florida corporation. And then there's also multiple counts in the case, and they divide into two basic types. There's the defamation, you know, libel, and then there was what we call the Lanham Act claims, which is essentially unfair trade and torturous interference, meaning that I'm interfering with his business by saying untrue bad things about him. Now, the Lanham Act claims, those counts are dependent upon the theory that my article in Science-Based Medicine was commercial speech. That was essentially the entire legal argument. Was the article that I wrote commercial speech or not? Earlier this year in June, we had filed fairly early in the case an anti-SLAPP motion based upon California state's anti-SLAPP law. So for the California plaintiff, we filed an anti-SLAPP for the defamation part of the case. Does that make sense? And I won that. So the judge essentially threw out the defamation claims for the California plaintiff, and I was awarded fees. The exact amount has yet to be determined, but it's going to be something like 10 to 15% of the overall cost of the case. It's, you know, it's going to be nice, but it's not going to be a huge chunk.
Right.
But, and then after that, Tobinick dropped the defamation claims for the other plaintiffs because obviously they have no chance of winning. There's actually a legal term for this. Like, you can't rule one way for one plaintiff and another way for the other plaintiffs. So at that point, it was totally futile to continue with the defamation claims once I won my anti-slap, even though it only technically applied to one plaintiff.
Wait, right. So he saw the futility? Are you sure?
Well, I'm sure his lawyers told him, you know, as a matter of law, you can't possibly win for the other plaintiffs, given that the judge has already ruled that you don't have a defamation case for the one plaintiff that fell under the anti-slap statute in California. So all that was left at that point were the commercial speech, you know, Lanham Act part of the claims against me personally. And that took several months to work through. So, Tobinick had an opportunity for discovery, you know, looked to troll through all of my emails, and that's when he deposed Jay. And essentially what he was trying to prove was that I make money from my skeptical activism, under the theory that because what I do generates income, that renders the article commercial speech.
That's so bizarre. So that would basically say that any newspaper has ads, no free speech there either. So that is unbelievable.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's extraordinary. It was a very extraordinary theory, and it would absolutely gut the First Amendment protections for, anyone who either directly or incidentally makes money off of their free speech. Suddenly it's commercial speech. Right. Now the judge ruled that it wasn't commercial speech at the summary judgment for the Society for Science-Based Medicine earlier this year. She ruled a second time that it wasn't commercial speech when she dismissed his motion for injunctive relief earlier this year. That was twice. He persisted in the claims despite the judge twice ruling it wasn't commercial speech. And then finally, in my motion for summary judgment, she said, it's still not commercial speech. You know, here are the three criteria. It doesn't meet any of the criteria. It's not commercial speech. Therefore, the two remaining counts have to be thrown out. Therefore, she granted me summary judgment. That's basically what it comes down to. In the meantime, he really got creative trying to expand the case, trying to accuse me of being in a conspiracy with other people, and it was just really crazy. I write about it in more detail on science-based medicine. I link to all of the judge's the major decisions in the case, so you could read everything for yourself. It's all public documents, so you could delve as deeply as you want into the case and see, you know, all the back and forth that was made. But the bottom line is we've now won the case. So what does that mean going forward? First of all, he has the option of appealing. My personal opinion is that an appeal would be futile. That doesn't mean he's not going to do it.
And just to clarify, because I didn't know this, an appeal means that what they're saying is that the judge made a significant error in the case. It's not that an appeal isn't like, let's try this all over again.
No, they have the burden of proof of proving that the judge made a legal mistake or that she failed to consider pertinent information.
Right. Very difficult. Yeah.
So in any case,
how bad could that appeal get? I mean,
it'll probably take a year and cost $100,000. If he decides to appeal.
Isn't it possible, the other person who vets this, couldn't he just read it over and be like, clearly there was no glaring error here. Let's just nip this in the bud and just end this.
You would think so, that it would be just like a quick sniff test, you know, to see if it goes forward. But he gets his day in court again. So anyway, Tobinick so far hasn't appealed, but that option is open to him. We are going to be asking for fees, you know, for the remainder of the fees. I doubt we'll get everything. It remains to be seen how much we're going to get. And there are other things that might happen in the case that I don't want to talk about. So it's not over yet. We will definitely get some money back because we've already been awarded partial fees on the California anti-slap, but it remains to be seen how much that will be. When there's a final tallying of the entire cost of the case versus how much we received in donations from our listeners versus how much we got back in fees, we'll let everyone know what that is. Specifically, I don't think this is going to happen, but if we end up with more money than what we started with because we got more donations than whatever the shortfall is, we'll let everybody know. And as we said from the beginning, in the unlikely event that that happens, that money will go into a legal defense fund to protect science-based medicine and SGU from any future suits.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's much, much more likely that we're going to be in the red on this.
Yeah, we're probably going to be in the red, but we'll see. You never know what's going to happen. You know, we're exploring all of our options. Let me just say that. So anyway, this is the bottom line. Although it's complicated and it's not entirely over yet, this is good news. We won the case. The judge decided that Tobinick's case has essentially no merit. My articles were not commercial speech. She's already decided that his case had no merit in terms of defamation. So it's, for now, the case is won, and then we'll give you an update once all the dust has settled.
Yay, yeah. Congratulations!
Thank you.
Yeah, really.
The really good news is that this was epically stressful for me, and I'm sure it was even more profoundly stressful for Steve since he was in the front line. And the fact that we don't have to really talk about it anywhere near as much as we did, I can't believe that we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Maybe we'll get a break for a while. We'll see what happens. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. We're going to be talking about the Nobel Prizes. So, Bob, you have sort of a special version of the Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
This is your Forgotten Supervillains of Science.
You went with supervillains?
Yeah, I did.
Antiheroes?
I did go with that. This week, I'm going to talk about a bunch of supervillains of sorts that all have won Nobel Prizes, but they've also won recriminations due to other aspects of their achievements. I got a few here. William Shockley was the co-inventor of the immensely important transistor. How epic was that? He won that in 1956, but he was also a supporter of eugenics, and he supported financial incentives to have races that he considered intellectually inferior, sterilized.
Yes.
So, yeah, nice. Then there was Carey Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993 for improving PCR. That's polymerase chain reaction. Is that right? Yeah.
Chain reaction. Hugely important.
Oh, my God.
Technology.
Yeah, just amplify. Takes a little bit of DNA and makes it a lot of it. So he improved it. He didn't really invent it, but he made a key improvement. But he also believes in astrology, that aliens might have appeared to him in the guise of a talking and glowing raccoon. And wow. he's often tripped on LSD. And I think those last two just may be related. And he's also an HIV denialist.
Ooh, HIV denialist.
Incredible. The last guy I got here, James Watson. Oh, boy.
Watson and Crick? Watson?
The co-discoverer of the structure of DNA is both famous and infamous. He's made some very... he said a lot of crazy stuff. He's made some very nasty suggestions in the past that say, for example, that there's a link between race and libido, or that there's a connection between weight and ambition. And he seems to be stuck on people that are overweight. He also is quoted in 2000 as saying, whenever you interview fat people, you feel bad because you know you're not going to hire them.
What?
Whoa, okay,
hello.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He said that in 2000.
I'm looking at the picture of this guy. He's 95 pounds soaking wet, this guy. Everyone's fat compared to him.
So he's got a couple more. Let's see. Oh, yeah. He said that regarding the equality of all humans, he said, people who have to deal with black employees find this not true. So I was like, wow, okay. Uh-huh. But then I found out that he later found out that he... 16% of his genome is of African ancestry. I wonder how, you know, we all, I'm sure have that at some point, but that must have been a nice surprise for him. And one thing that really gets to me that he famously has never properly credited Rosalind Franklin, whose X-ray crystallography was critical to his DNA structure discovery. And I talked about her earlier in the year.
That's right.
And that was just terrible. I mean, she made a major contribution. And he just, you know, was very happy not to have her included. So remember these guys, or don't. Mention them to your friends, perhaps when they're being assholes.
Now, Bob, there's one Nobel laureate that you didn't add to your list, but I have to include him. And that's Dr. Luc Montagnier. He's a French virologist who ironically discovered the AIDS virus. Won the Nobel Prize in 2008. So another Nobel laureate is an AIDS denialist, but the guy who discovered the AIDS virus is supportive of homeopathy.
And of course lends
the prestige of a Nobel laureate to perhaps the worst medical pseudoscience on Earth.
Right. Yeah, of all time, yep.
Yeah. Right. I also wanted to thank National Geographic. They wrote an article about this. I got a lot of these people from them.
Yeah.
And it was a good article. But this is a very good idea, Steve. This is a really funny take on superheroes of science.
Now, let me ask you another question, because this comes up in a lot of contexts. One question is, how much of a break do people get for being a product of the culture of their time? You know what I mean? The example I always give is, by today's standards, Abraham Lincoln was a horrible racist.
Yeah, sure.
Now, that's a really good point, Steve. And when I was going through trying to find people to other people to include in this, if it was like 100 years ago, I kind of just swept right over them. I didn't even include them because I was trying to include the culture at the time, which kind of, to a certain extent, attenuates it depending on how radical they are, of course. But I think that's a factor that you might want to consider with stuff like this.
Yeah, but I agree. It may be, if you go back far enough, it mitigates it a little bit.
Yeah,
I think you have to take it. You have to take it into consideration. It doesn't excuse it, of course, because there were people at the time who were progressive and, you know, who were anti-slavery, for example, even 150, 200 years ago. But I think people get a little self-righteous and it's like, really, I wonder what you would have been like 200 years ago. You know what I mean? If you were born 200 years ago, do you think you would have been at the progressive end of the spectrum, or would you have been right there in the middle with most everybody else that you're now criticizing? Just be a little... You know, at least acknowledge that we're all a product of our time. And, you know, you take a lot of credit because we stand on the shoulders of giants. But just be, anyway, it's more not so much of an excuse for them, but just humility for people today.
Absolutely.
Don't be so much on your high horse.
That's such a good point, too, which is why I think Bob's segment is so great, because when he does talk about these forgotten superheroes, oftentimes they are women or they are exceptional individuals, African Americans, people who didn't have rights or a place in history. And they were those people that were on the extreme end of the spectrum that were fighting back. Most of us would not fall in that place.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Another thing to keep you honest, Steve, I often think of 100 years from now, society will certainly look back on us and even us progressives and say, what the hell were you thinking?
Yeah.
It's hard to predict how that will happen and what specifically they will find so egregious, but they will certainly find some things that just shock the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That we take like, oh, what? Really? We would be shocked.
Oh, those fossil fuels. We're barbarians.
Eating meat. Yeah. Eating meat and driving gasoline cars.
Yep.
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 Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. We did have that conversation on the show previously.
Yes.
Anyway, so the Nobel Prizes for 2015 in chemistry, physics, and medicine were announced in the last couple of days. Jay, tell us about the physics prize.
Yeah. The Nobel Prize in physics was awarded to two people. And it was about neutrinos. So what the hell are neutrinos? And I know Bob probably has a very good understanding. They are subatomic particles. And that means what? That they're smaller than an atom. Some people don't know that.
Hence subatomic.
Exactly. And neutrinos are everywhere.
Everywhere.
They're freaking everywhere.
They're ubiquitous is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Omnipresent?
A trillion just went through you right now.
That's right.
Right now,
at
boom,
least
trillion.
More than a trillion.
Yeah.
The only particle more common is the photon.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Neutrinos are so small.
How small are they?
It's rare for them to even interact with anything, right? Think about that. Like Bob said, they're passing through you right now. They're so small from a neutrino's perspective, they are almost always in empty space. Like if you're a neutrino, you don't really see anything.
No, real important, Jay. It's not so much a matter of their small size. It's the fact that they have no charge, so they don't interact with anything.
Yeah, that's part of it as well.
Yeah,
very rarely.
So this is why it's hard to study them, right? They, like Bob was saying, they have no charge. They don't interact. So how do you study these guys? No charge means a lot of different things. But check this out: neutrinos are created in nuclear reactions.
And they're also creating nuclear reactions.
And nuclear reactions.
I'm going to mispronounce Einstein and Einstein. Nuclear my whole life. I'm okay with that.
You could do Einstein. Einstein's cute, but not nuclear. Work on that one.
All right. There's three types or flavors of neutrinos. Mm. Bob, what are they?
Vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry.
No, one of them is peach.
Muon, tau, and electron.
Right.
Those are the three types or flavors of neutrinos. Keep that in mind. We have neutrino detectors, and these are buried really deep below the surface, and we do that to protect from the interference from any other type of particles. We just want to be studying neutrinos and not see anything else. And what we do is we build these giant pools of water. Well, this is one way to do it. They build giant pools of water that are virtually surrounded by photon detectors. And when a neutrino, very uncommon, but when it does happen, when it hits an atom, it bounces off an atom, a little bit of light is created, and that's how we study them. We're just waiting for them to interact. And when we catch one interacting, we take a hard look at that and we could figure some stuff out. So now, back in the 90s, we didn't understand at all why neutrino detectors were only detecting a fraction of what the theoretical models told us we should be seeing. And we didn't understand that, you know, why aren't we seeing, you know, five times more than we are, whatever.
So yeah, that was important, Jay. It's called the solar neutrino problem. And it was kind of like, what the hell's going on? Because our theories say we should be seeing X and we're seeing only about one third of X. So that could mean potentially that our understanding of solar dynamics is completely off because it's not producing as many neutrinos as we thought. So that was a real pressing problem.
I know I've said this on the show before, but a creationist actually said to me at the time that that was evidence for a young universe. See, because the sun is not powered by nuclear reactions, but it's just contracting under gravity, and that's heating it up.
God.
Said, yeah, I bet you we'll solve the solar neutrino problem pretty soon, and it didn't take too long.
Yeah, that's awesome. So as several teams studied neutrinos, there was an amazing discovery, and this brings us to this year's winners of the Nobel Prize in Physics. Takaki Kajita and Arthur MacDonald both led teams who had been studying neutrinos for over 15 years, and what they both discovered, these two teams, I think I did read that they were sharing information, they discovered that neutrinos can change their flavor from one to another during flight. And now this is profound.
Wow.
Yeah, right? How cool is that? Yep. So this is a very significant discovery because it explained why we only observed a portion of the predicted amount of neutrinos that we thought we should be observing. And also, and I think more importantly, I don't know, but it sounds more important, we found out that they actually have mass.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know they had mass. Now think about that.
A tiny amount, yeah.
Yeah, the fact that they change they can change flavors means that they must have mass because you'd have to have mass to do that. So yeah.
So now all of a sudden we're thinking all these particles that didn't have mass, now they have mass and we have to account for that mass. So what happened was those neutrino discoveries that were made contradicted the standard model of particle physics. And you know, it just changed the way we calculate the nature of the universe, and it gave us a new way to look at the expansion of the universe. Because everything has to be accounted for, right? Everything that has mass, everything that's affected by gravity. Like, you know, we're trying to do a gigantic collection of mathematical equations so we can make some sense out of the universe. And switching the switch from off to on as far as neutrinos having mass was a huge switch to flick.
Yeah, but just to clarify, it didn't show that the standard model was wrong, just that it's incomplete. It won't explain everything. Yeah,
I was going to say that, yeah.
So one last thought here, Professor Stefan Soldner-Rembold, and he's a physicist at the University of Manchester, said the following, that this is a groundbreaking discovery by two large experimental collaborations. The discovery of neutrino masses and of neutrino oscillations are the first crack in the standard model of particle physics, and that the era of exciting discoveries in neutrino physics has only just begun.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear that.
All right. Well, next we're going to move on to medicine, physiology or medicine, the Nobel Prize. This goes to three individuals. William Campbell and Satoshi Omura share one half of the prize for their discovery of a treatment for roundworm parasites. And UU2 gets the other half for her discovery of a treatment for malaria. So both of these prizes are for finding treatments for parasitic infections. Now I know sitting in the comfort of our first world, you know, locations, we aren't plagued by parasites that much, but parasites actually are a massive plague to this day, on most of the world. At least half of the world's population, about 3.5 billion, live in areas where parasitic infections are endemic. We know that malaria, for example, affects millions of people. And also let me talk about the Campbell and Omura Prize first. They jointly discovered a drug called ivermectin. Ivermectin and its derivatives have been used to treat river blindness and lymphatic filariasis. They isolated their drug from a bacteria, Streptomyces, which is a soil bacteria. We talked about previously how, you know, bacteria produce a lot of antimicrobials, and they're a great source of antibiotics and of drugs. And So that's where theirs came from. But I want to spend a little bit more time talking about UU2's prize because of the way that that has been reported. Up until around 2000, when she discovered her drug, chloroquine and quinine were the mainstay drugs for the treatment of malaria. Unfortunately, like with everything, you use a compound for long enough and things evolve and resistance occurs. So resistance to quinine and chloroquine were becoming a huge problem. And so we were pretty desperate for a new anti-parasitic drug, anti-malarial drug. And UU2 set out to find one. So this is what she did. She identified 2,000 possible natural or plant-based compounds that might be useful against malaria. And she did this by pouring through herbalism texts, looking for anything that anyone has ever used to treat fever. Now, she went for fever as a symptom because they didn't necessarily know that they were treating malaria. A lot of these texts came from a time before they even had a concept of disease. You know, they didn't even realize that people have different specific diseases. It's just you have symptoms. From the 2000, she narrowed it down a number of ways until she got, you know, to the high probability ones. And that led her to a plant called Artemisia. And she purified from that a drug called artemisinin. But she had a hard time getting it to function. The early tests looking at malaria in mice were mixed. And so she went back over other texts talking about how to prepare it. And one of the texts said that you need to steep it in cold water. And that gave her the idea, well, maybe boiling it, which is how she was extracting it, was inactivating the active ingredient. And it was. So then she figured out how to purify it from there. You know, since around 2000, artemisinin has become an incredibly important anti-malaria drug. She's clearly saved millions of lives, totally deserves a Nobel Prize for this. What's interesting is that this has been reported as vindication for traditional Chinese medicine. And in fact, naturopaths are saying that this is a vindication of naturopathy, which it isn't. And, you know, they're in making that claim, they link to reports on it that don't even mention naturopathy. What this is a vindication for is modern science. Let me tell you the process they went through to get artemisinin. First of all, they looked at 2,000 candidate substances, and they had to study them scientifically to figure out which ones had activity. Once they purified sort of the raw form from the plant, it actually isn't a good treatment unto itself because, and this is true, this is what plagues herbalism in general, is that, you know, in order for a drug, and herbs are drugs, make no mistake, in order for a drug to be useful medically, it has to simultaneously have a long list of properties. So, for example, a drug has to have good bioavailability. It has to get absorbed by the body, in other words, and whichever route you give it. It has to be either water or fat soluble, you know, to get it into a form that you can take and get it into the body. It has to be stable enough that it will last. It has to produce, obviously, a medically exploitable physiological effect in a dose that's practical and that doesn't cause excessive side effects or toxicity. It has to have a reasonable half-life. And, you know, there's lots of other features like its drug-drug interactions. If it binds too much to the albumin in your blood, then it won't be that effective and it will interfere with other drugs that bind to albumin. So there's a lot of things that could make a drug not useful, even if it has the activity that we're going for. And that was the case with artemisinin. It actually was not, had a very low bioavailability and was quickly eliminated in the urine. So it, by itself, it wasn't useful. So Big Pharma got their hands on it and they do what they do. They tweaked the chemistry of the raw form in order to make it more bioavailable, more stable, more soluble in water. They're continuing to tweak it, removing parts that are not necessary in order to reduce side effects and toxicity. That's what you have to do. Now, they're also figuring out how to mass produce it. One thing that was done is they made a hybrid of the plant that has a higher concentration of the artemisinin in it, so you could produce more. But even that is not producing enough to meet worldwide demands. It's a malaria treatment. So they made a genetically modified yeast that will crank out precursors to the drug, and they're trying to figure out other processes essentially to mass produce it. So this is a success story for what is called pharmacognosy. Pharmacognosy is beginning with natural substances like plants and then figuring out active ingredients, modifying them so that they have properties that are necessary for it to be a viable drug, and figuring out how to produce it and turning it essentially into a pharmaceutical. That's what this is a story of. Not herbalism, not traditional Chinese medicine, certainly not naturopathy. It shows that, in fact, that, and again, keep in mind, they're making a lot of the fact that she got her original list of things to test from old texts of traditional Chinese medicine. That's fine. You know, where, how you generate your hypotheses is fine. And going for anecdotal evidence to say what, you know, as a starting point, it is perfectly reasonable. But keep in mind, out of 2,000 potential substances, she found one that was able to be turned into a drug that was effective. So in the proper context, this is not at all a story that vindicates either traditional Chinese medicine or herbalism or anything like that. This is a story of pharmacognosy and science developing a new drug to treat malaria.
I think that it's probably the way that a lot of drugs have been produced in the past.
It is, absolutely.
I mean, yeah. That's something that we forget, is that not everything is chemically synthesized in a lab. Sometimes things are collected out in nature, and, you know, sometimes
a lot. Absolutely. Think about it this way, too. Think about it this way. Nature is full of millions of organisms that are all trying to kill everyone else, right? That's basically what's going on out there.
We're winning.
Plants are trying. Plants evolve all kinds of chemicals to kill off anything that will try to eat it or interfere with it or whatever. Most of the pesticides that you eat, the estimate I've seen is 99%, although I don't know how carefully vetted that is, but it sounds reasonable. But most of the pesticides that you eat are natural pesticides that plants make for themselves to defend themselves from pests. Mm-hmm. That's and what we're doing is we're just trying to find the horribly toxic, awful chemicals that have evolved in nature, but that we can exploit. And often, again, we have to change them so that we can exploit one property of them while making them bioavailable and not horribly toxic so that we can tolerate them. And then even then, we're always flirting with the edge. Let's face it. All drugs have side effects. You know, we're always trying to minimize toxicity, and they don't work perfectly well. You know what I mean? It's because, because biology is complicated and it's a kludge. We evolved. You know, we don't have these pristine receptors that all do only one thing. Receptors evolved from common ancestors of other receptors, and everything has a messy effect in the body. That's why there are side effects. But yeah, we're getting good. We're clever at exploiting, you know, the natural pharmacy that's out there in nature. But it's not easy, you know, and it's certainly not a simple matter of just brewing a tea from plants and thinking that the hundreds of chemicals you're going to get are going to have all the properties you need to be a useful drug. That's magical thinking. All right, one more Nobel Prize. Evan, chemistry.
I'll take it right from the NobelPrize.org website because I think they summed it up really great. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry for 2015 is awarded to Thomas Lindahl, Paul Modrick, and Aziz Sankar for having mapped at a molecular level how cells repair damaged DNA and safeguard the genetic information. Each day, our DNA is damaged by UV radiation, free radicals, and other carcinogenic substances. But even without such external attacks, a DNA molecule is inherently unstable. Thousands of spontaneous changes to a cell's genome occurs on a daily basis. Furthermore, defects can also arise when DNA is copied during cell division, a process that occurs several million times every day in our bodies. The reason our genetic material does not disintegrate into complete chemical chaos is that a host of molecular systems continuously monitor and repair DNA. So it was the early 1970s when scientists believed that DNA was this stable molecule. But it was Thomas Lindahl who demonstrated that DNA decays at a rate that ought to have made the development on life, of life on Earth impossible. This insight led him to discover a molecular machinery called base excision repair, which constantly counteracts the collapse of our DNA. Aziz Sankar has mapped nucleotide excision repair, which is the mechanisms that cells use to repair UV damage to DNA. People born with defects in this repair system will develop skin cancer if they're exposed to sunlight. The cell also utilizes nucleotide excision repair to correct defects caused by mutagenic substances, among other things. And Paul Modrick has demonstrated how the cells correct errors that occur when DNA is replicated during cell division. The mechanism, called mismatch repair, reduces the error frequency during DNA replication by about a thousandfold.
That's all seminal work in our understanding of DNA. All right, well, the next part of the show, we are going to be talking about The Martian. We played our interview with Andy Weir last week. We've all seen the movie now, and we're going to talk about it. But Kara, you're going to introduce it by giving us a little background on how the movie came about.
Yeah. So as you know, The Martian, starring Matt Damon, premiered on Friday, October 2nd. I was one of those nerds who went and saw it on Thursday night.
Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. I was there at the 9:15 showing, even though I had a 5 a.m. pickup for the airport the next morning because I'm crazy.
Ouch.
The Martian is based on the book published in February of 2014 by Andy Weir, and it was published by Random House. But there are two copyright dates for Andy Weir in the book jacket. One of them is 2014 and one is 2011. And this is why. You may not know this, but Andy took 3 years to write The Martian, researching the science, doing his own calculations, and doing mappings. But he actually started the whole thing as a self-published blog. In a piece that was written about this for Smithsonian Magazine by Victoria Jaggard, there's some great quotes from Andy. And one of them that I think is really telling is one where he says, quote, "I had tried before to write novels and submitted them to agents, but no one was interested. If it weren't for the internet, the story wouldn't have been possible at all because I wouldn't have had any medium to tell stories. I wasn't even trying to break into the industry anymore. I was doing it as a labor of love." So at this point, Andy Weir has no interest, really. I mean, I'm sure he had an interest, but no fantasy of making money off of this book. And what he did is he's just started publishing chapters. It was a web-based serial, and he published a new chapter kind of every 6 to 8 weeks. And as he would publish chapters, more and more people started sharing them, more and more people started responding, and eventually he had this core of about 3,000 readers that were really devoted and that would fact-check everything that he would write. So one guy is featured in this Smithsonian piece. His name is Fred Califf, and he's a geologist and geospatial information scientist with NASA's JPL. He had just finished his PhD on Mars impact craters. He became obsessed with these chapters that Andy Weir was publishing, and he started to write to him on a regular basis, giving him a lot of feedback on the book. I love this. In his reply, Weir told Califf after the first time he reached out, quote, "Your points are not only useful, they are precognitive." So really, without these great people reading these serialized chapters, Andy says that he would not have been able to do this. And also featured in this article is an interview with Rosalind Williams, who is the Dibner Professor of the History of Science and Technology at MIT. And she actually compares Andy Weir to Jules Verne in the article. Jules Verne, of course, wrote 20,000 Leagues wow. Under the Sea, because she sure. says that, you know, back then, the way that Jules wrote, there was no internet, obviously. He would read magazines and journals voraciously. He would go to scientific lectures, to different demonstrations, to different symposia, and he would crowdsource ideas. He would go to these social clubs in Paris, and he would talk to scientists and have them fact check his work. And that's how he kind of almost in many ways invented this genre of the scientifically accurate science fiction novel. And in many ways, The Martian really follows in those footsteps. Now, there are two major plot points that Weir knows were not scientifically accurate, but he kept them in service to the plot, which I think is not something that we should scoff at. And it's something that we will discuss right now in the movie review.
Yeah, so as always, when we review movies like this, we're going to do a deep dive on certain parts of the movie. There will be spoilers galore. So if you want to watch the movie before listening to this review, then fast forward to the end of this. Fast forward to 1 hour and 7 minutes. We're going to talk about the movie as a film, and then we're going to do a deep dive on the science in the movie. And let me just start by saying, I freaking loved this movie. I mean, I don't know how you could not love it as a scientist and a skeptic. I mean, it was, as many people have characterized it, a love letter to science and NASA.
Mm-hmm. Andy didn't really care about following any type of, you know, modern format or what the current movies are, what you might consider to be a typical plot line. Like he picked, first off, it was man versus nature. Or man versus himself, I guess, in a sense, you know, the Matt Damon
character. It was
character.
Man versus nature. I mean, yeah, Mars was the villain. You know, it was man versus nature. And it was also Robinson Crusoe and somebody stranded.
It was a coming-of-age story. No,
Castaway.
Castaway.
Yeah, you know, like stranded on a desert island.
It's a castaway story, sure, like The Castaway or Robinson Crusoe, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, there's precedence for this genre. But, yeah, it was definitely – it didn't seem predictable or like I've seen it before, you know. Yeah,
well, on that note, predictability. I think a lot of it was incredibly predictable in terms of you knew Whatley was going to be saved. That was a no-brainer.
Oh yeah,
you knew no one else was going to die. That was almost as much of a no.
I don't know about that.
I also don't know if either of those points were necessary to the plot. I mean, that was like secondary to the plot.
Let me finish. You knew that NASA was going to commit to save them. There was the broad strokes. You knew a lot of what was going to happen, and that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They didn't fight the predictability. Some movies are predictable, and they try to fight against that. This, as one author said, one quote from Mahler's Seats, he said that the most fascinating thing about the film is how it leans into predictability rather than make a show of fighting it. And so it didn't even matter that a lot of it, at least in my mind, was predictable.
Yeah.
The how was awesome. It was such a fun movie.
I agree. When movies pretend like they're not predictable, it's silly.
It's like, annoying, too.
Yeah, it's like, don't make it seem like you're there's any suspense about whether or not this guy's going to die when we know he isn't. You know, just forget about it.
You insult the intelligence of the audience at a certain point with all that. You know what made this movie for me, besides all the great points you guys have brought up? And this is something I've brought up in movie reviews before. It's something that I always, sort of, whatever reason, I focus on, is the character and how I feel, how I relate. Sure. To the personalities and to the characters. And I know in that last Jurassic Park movie, you know, I expressed that I had absolutely no connection whatsoever to these characters. Mm-hmm. This was just the opposite. Yeah. I really cared about what certainly Mark Whatley was thinking and feeling, but everyone, all the rest of his crew members, the people on Earth and sort of how they were feeling all about. I even, the Dumb and Dumber guy at NASA, Jeff Daniels, that character. I even empathized with him having to be in the position that he was in as the head of NASA and having to deal with the kind of ideas and decisions in the big picture that he had to deal with. So I really felt that connection with these characters.
It's funny that you mentioned, Evan, that you really identified with Mark Whatley, because Andy Weir has been quoted in multiple interviews saying that he didn't really develop the character. And if you're looking for a deep dive into a complex struggle of an interesting character, that this is not the book to read. Although I completely disagree with that. Maybe he was just writing for himself. But what I love is that they didn't have to pander. In the book, he didn't have a wife. He didn't have kids. They didn't have to talk about, you know, that's why he had to come. And I love that in the movie, they didn't go there. When I first saw the trailer.
He had a mother and father, and that was enough.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was enough.
One throwaway quote.
The turning point for me, the big exclamation point in the movie was when he almost deadpans you, the audience, and says, I have to science the shit out of this.
Oh, yeah, it's everybody's
when
favorite quote.
He said that.
The best quote, of course, it's the
obvious quote in the movie, but I love that so much because, how do I put this? It's like he's wielding science not as a weapon, but as a way to survive.
To survive, to solve problems. Yeah. Again, this is where the NASA part comes into it, because I think the character of Mark Whatley was the quintessential astronaut. And the character gives this talk at the end of the movie when he's teaching in class. He's like, what are you going to do? You're faced with a life and death situation. You could give in, or you could just roll up your sleeves and get to work. Solve one problem, mm-hmm. then you solve the next. And if you solve enough problems, you're going to live. That's like the whole NASA credo right mm-hmm. there. And, you know, they're solving problems. They're cool and collected, and they're using, you know, science and engineering and technology and just, you know, being very versatile and innovative or whatever in order to do that. And I love that. That's to me, they're, what do they call it? Like technology porn yeah. or competency porn?
I love that.
Yeah, competency porn. We're just watching somebody really super competent solve a really difficult problem. I love that.
And
that was this movie from beginning to end.
How powerful it is not only to see people using their mind, doing a good job, but everybody was a science advocate.
Yeah.
The heroes of this movie were all scientists. They were all mm-hmm. interesting people. Like, it broke the mold in a sense too. Like, you know, can we formally put down the crazy scientist in the lab coat thing and yeah. move into, you know, the modern age where, you know what, scientists are fascinating people that do fascinating things. And we just watched.
They're real people with feelings.
That's why Watney was such a great character. And, you know, you talked about that, I'm going to science the shit out of this planet quote. And that's kind of a highlight in the film, but the book is littered with those kinds of quotes. He's really funny and he's really nonchalant oftentimes. And that's why I think so many people love him, because he is a scientist and he is an astronaut and he's a total badass. But at the same time, yep. he's human. I think one of my favorite mm-hmm. quotes from the book that didn't make it into the movie, and I'll keep it tight here, was, okay, here we go. He's stuck out there. He thinks he's totally alone and that we've all given up on him. What kind of effect does that have on a man's psychology? He turned back to Venkat. I wonder what he's thinking right now. Cut to his journal entries, because that was the device that was used in the book. Log entry, Sol 61. How come Aquaman can control whales? They're mammals. Makes no sense.
right.
That's awesome. Nice.
This is the whole book, is him solving problems, but being so funny and so human about it, although he is a technical genius.
Yeah.
I have a question. Did he really have to use his own feces in order to make the plants?
No, he used everybody's.
He used everyone's.
He food. Did use everybody's? Yeah. Okay, because the one close-up they had, it was specifically his bag. I didn't know if there was a purpose to that specifically.
No.
I missed.
There was absolutely no purpose to them freeze-drying them individually either. There's no way they would do that. Like, that was one of the scientific inaccuracies that I read. That,
well,
like, they maybe they want to research their own poo, but they're there to study Mars. They're not there to study their own freeze-dried poo.
No, I think that was there so they didn't contaminate the planet.
No, but I'm saying, why would they be individually bagged and labeled by each other's names?
That
part doesn't make any sense. But
labeled doesn't make any sense. But just individually sealing off the waste as a way of minimizing contamination, at least, is, you could see them doing that. But it sounds like we're transitioning to the next part, which is the science in the movie.
Yes, baby.
Yay.
But you can't help, it's hard to separate.
Overall, very scientifically accurate movie. But let's talk about some of the things that were not so accurate first. The first scene in the movie. Now, again, as Andy Weir said, every now and then you have to do things for the story to work. And he knows he's sort of fudging the science, but without it, you don't have a story. So what's the point? So right out of the gate, the team is forced to leave Mars. They think that Watney is dead. But they have to leave very, very quickly because there's, you know, one of the infamous Martian dust storms is hitting the place where they're working, and they have to get their ship out so it doesn't tip over. That would not happen. The Martian atmosphere is about 1/100th of an Earth atmosphere. It just doesn't have the power to move anything other than a small grain of dust. They're dust storms because nothing bigger than a grain of dust could be picked up and blown by such a wispy atmosphere. It would not have been as they portrayed it, and it certainly wouldn't have blown over their ship.
Yeah, it just wouldn't happen, and he knew it.
Yeah,
Andy knew it. He said, I got a quote from him. He said, "I needed a way to force the astronauts off the planet, so I allowed myself some leeway Plus, I thought the storm would be pretty cool. So yeah, so yeah. He knew it. That to me, that's the biggest gimme. Sure, you get a few gimmies in a movie. That's the biggest one, and I'm totally fine with that. Even though you know, any of these dust storms on Mars never really exceeds 60 miles an hour. But even if they hit 100 miles an hour, that would have the same force as a 1 mile per hour wind. I mean, it would clearly there would be no problem in terms of knocking over anything. Yeah.
And he said that there were other options. You know, it could have been an engine failure thing. There were other things he wrestled with. But because one of those core themes that he wanted to keep up with was this man versus nature theme, and because he knew it would create such a really interesting image in your mind when you were reading about it, that he stuck with it regardless of the inaccuracy.
Right. All right. Let's stick with the atmosphere. So the other thing that struck me was at one point, the airlock to the HAB, the...
Okay, what did the
Which
HAB
is short
for
habitat.
The habitat.
Okay. Short for habitat.
That malfunctioned and blew off. So then he had this gaping hole in the side of his habitat. And so he fixed it with plastic and duct tape. That would not work. I can't imagine how that would work. Now, I've read a lot of technical analysis of the movie, and I didn't find one where somebody specifically pointed out the fact that if you do the calculation, you know, what's the PSI of one atmosphere? You take that, was it 15, 16 PSI?
15, I think. That's what the readings were on.
Multiply that by the area of the opening, and there's tons of pressure pushing that out. You're not holding in. Just imagine holding up tons of weight with duct tape and tarp or plastic. Yeah. It just...
I mean, duct tape's great and all, but...
And then they show it flapping in the wind, too. No, that thing would be bulging out. There's an atmosphere pressure pushing out on it, and there's almost nothing in, 1/100th of an atmosphere pushing in. That wouldn't have worked, and it didn't even look right. If he did make something strong enough, it would have been bulging. You know, it would not have been flapping in the breeze.
And I wonder if that was in service to some of the comedy, because there's some great duct tape quotes in the book also. Yeah. One of my favorite is, yes, of course duct tape works in a near vacuum. Duct tape works anywhere. Duct tape is magic and should be worshipped.
It should be. He had to patch his helmet with it, too. Yeah. He almost died if he didn't have it handy.
I have a question, guys. Yeah. I'm not that familiar with the gravity on Mars. Would they be walking or hopping on
Point
Mars?
0.4.
They would be hopping.
Yeah, it'd be like 40%. Modified 40%. Walk, hop. 40%. Yeah, definitely. They would not be strolling around like in 1G.
Why do you think Ridley Scott chose not to do that? Because they did all this work to make them inside of the spaceship that the rest of the crew was in. They did a lot of work to try and make it look weightless or make them be pulled down by the kind of centrifuge of that cool portion of the spaceship that kept them on their feet. But
and the transitions were cool too.
I'll tell you why I think, Kara.
Right.
Uh-huh.
It would probably have been phenomenally expensive.
Because most of the movie was shot with Matt Damon. Yeah.
It would have been an extra step. It would have been nice if they did the... And even... Yeah. Assume that that's a money practical thing.
Probably.
Like even 2001 A Space Odyssey, my favorite movie of all time, which is incredibly scientifically accurate, when they're walking around on the moon inside buildings, there's magically 1G of gravity. Yeah. And it's not the case.
Do they have a gravity generator? No. I mean, there's some hidden technology that they never explain.
No way, man. Not at that time. Also, if we're going to stick with gravity a little bit longer, Steve, you mentioned the transitions from the center of the torus, going from the micro G to the chutes going down to close to higher gravity. So those transitions were beautiful, but I think they were a little bit off as well, because think about it, you're transitioning from micro G into a spinning torus, the bottom of a spinning torus. The Coriolis force would pretty much bang you against the side walls. I'm pretty sure that's what would happen, but that's fine. I mean, that was it was such a beautiful transition. I didn't mind.
Well, they were
it.
Holding onto the ladder. Would that have been enough to keep them in place?
Once they grabbed it, but once you start entering that tube, you would be shoved. You would definitely be shoved towards one of the walls.
You're saying it shouldn't have been this smooth sort of ballet. Instead, it would have been more like a rocky, sort of half falling.
They would have to get accelerated up to the velocity of the spinning centrifuge, right? So that they would have to be pushed into spinning around with it. And they would have been pushed laterally.
Right. Yeah, and it's a constant increase in speed as you go down.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Also, the other thing that the Taurus, some guy looked at this Taurus and did some back of the envelope calculations. So he estimated that it was a 20-meter Taurus, which sounded reasonable. So that means it would need a 9-second revolution if you're going to simulate Earth gravity. So he calculated
much faster.
He calculated for a 20-meter Taurus, I think nine seconds for one complete revolution sounds about right. I mean, I didn't do the math.
So, Bob, it wasn't seem to be fast enough? It didn't seem to be going that fast.
No, I'm just saying that assuming that, that's what it would have to be. Assuming that, he said it would be very disorienting to walk because the difference between the gravitational pull of your head and your feet would be noticeable. So it would be very disorienting to walk. And even if you stood up, just from laying down, if you stood up, you could potentially just fall down because you'd be like, whoa, like you were actually hit with something. So that might have been a little bit off as well, assuming his calculations are correct. But that was just an interesting aside.
Yeah, but after months, they got used to it after months.
Another part of the movie that really impressed me was the fact that they spent as much time as they did showing how difficult orbital dynamics are, like launching a rocket. Timing the way the ships interact with each other and their altitude and speed, all of these things are so phenomenally critical in order
to slingshot effect. Yes,
right. And they, Ev, they spent real time in that movie. That was a plot device. That was part of the drama of the last scene of the movie was getting through that whole thing, and then we had to come up with something extraordinarily creative and risky in order to get him up to velocity to get him up there. I just loved all of that because,
of course, yes,
those scientists that work on these things that you have to be so skilled to do it. And they were thinking out of the box, that other character that came up with the flyby Earth slingshot and shoot the astronauts back to the planet and everything. That was really cool, but that was also like a very risky maneuver that they had to pull. And it probably took dozens, if not hundreds of mathematicians time crunching numbers to make it all be just right, just perfect.
And you only get one shot at it.
I think that NASA would have been all over that. I don't think that they needed some guy to come up with that idea. That was a dramatic plot device, but I think, NASA would have thought about that in about 2 seconds.
I don't know. I read an interview with one NASA worker who said that's actually a pretty kind of believable plot device.
Really?
That it's not uncommon where there's a very junior person working in JPL or at NASA or whatever who comes up with some sort of out-of-the-box idea because everybody, the more senior you get, the more stuck in your ways you get. And you kind of think in terms of protocol. And it's not uncommon for like one random kind of junior person to have an idea that's bigger than everybody else. And they all have to check themselves and say, wait, could we do this? Wait, should we listen to this guy? And that's really kind of what they played up. I like that he was just, eating ramen and drinking coffee and staying up all night. And he was like 25.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought that the slingshot idea wouldn't be – that's not that out of the box.
Oh, gotcha,
NASA,
gotcha,
they
gotcha.
Do that all the time. That's like they're slingshotting all over the solar system. Gravity assist. So since we're talking about getting Watney up to rendezvous with the Hermes, what do you guys think about the Iron Man controlling his – this is like right out of Gravity, when she uses the fire extinguisher to – rocket herself over.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Although it's incredibly problematic.
Yeah,
that is dangerous.
First of all, you've got to make sure that he got to make sure he didn't stab himself, because if he stabbed himself, then the coagulating blood would actually seal the hole, and that has actually happened once in real life.
Well, that's how he was saved in the beginning. Yeah. That's how he didn't die in the first dust storm.
Well, right. Bob, I admit it was really cool. It was fun. I loved that they wove in Iron Man into it, like because he's a sci-fi fan himself. I love that, but I couldn't help but think, God, he would not be able to control himself.
Yeah, the control is huge. He could easily, just as easily, put himself into a spin that he would never get out of. Mm-hmm. It was such a risky maneuver. Plus, think about this. The size of the hole would have to be just perfect so that you don't depressurize the suit.
Yeah, right.
Quickly, which would cause him to die in possibly even seconds or even minutes. But also, it's got to give him a substantial propulsion to actually make it worthwhile. So, man, the tolerances are just so nasty. And then when he finally meets up with the pilot, the captain, some people were saying that the angular momentum, was not good in that scene. Cause, they got the spinning skater thing. The closer you get, the faster you know, conservation of angular momentum, and that seemed a little bit out of whack too. But still, I absolutely love that
scene.
Me
too, Bob. That being said, I was on the edge of my seat in that scene. I wanted success so badly. I wanted him to survive. I wanted everything to go right, and I was actually scared.
Yeah. Not to mention the physical limitations that somebody who has just spent 500 whatever days on the planet and is emaciated and barely, you know, can kind of really get around in normal circumstances would have to do. It's a physical feat that he's
really
trying. And
he's hardly conscious, like at this point, you know, he's blacked
he had to
out
12
and come
G's.
Back.
12 G's, yeah. Think about that scene, guys. That the captain came over in a jetpack. So why was she tethered?
I don't even think in the book that the captain is the one who was out there. It was always the guy, and he was always on a tether, and he was always spacewalking to collect him. I think that this was a scene that was definitely beefed up for drama for the film. But even in the book, it was a scene that was beefed up for drama, and that's why I think that the whole I'm going to fly like Iron Man portion was to give you that nail-biting, edge-of-your-seat, final hurrah.
Oh, sure.
Because everything else in the book is so calculated. And that's one thing you'll notice reading it. It's full of numbers. Every other sentence has numbers and units in it. And this was this, at the final throws, it was kind of like, screw doing math. I'm just going to stab myself in the hand and see what happens. And it was cool because it was in direct contradiction to them, you know, the tenseness of calculating, how can we decelerate enough? How can we move just a millimeter? How can we? But then he's like, oh, well, I'm going to fly like Iron Man, which I loved.
All right, let's talk about a couple other things.
Spacesuits.
So let's talk about a spacesuit. What's interesting is Jay and I independently agreed that the spacesuit was the coolest prop from the movie.
It was fantastic.
Talk about an epically cool-looking spacesuit. Can NASA please just make the spacesuits look like that?
No,
they can't.
No,
they can't.
Very form-fitting.
It's unrealistic. Yeah. It was unrealistic.
Right.
You know, they actually tried, though. They examined a lot of the prototype Mars suits, and they had some big problems. One, you couldn't see the human's face inside. That's a deal breaker.
Yeah.
And also, they were not film friendly. They were boring. They were too puffy. So they said, screw it. They pretty much created it from scratch, and they started with the minimum that you would need for life support, and then went from there. So it looked beautiful. I would love to have one, and I hope I see one at Dragon Con next year. But they would not work for very long in real life. So they were unrealistic.
Too Star Trek-y.
But I don't care. Yeah. I don't care. They were gorgeous.
There's one thing in the film that's scientifically inaccurate in the wrong direction, and that is the maps. All of the maps of Mars that Watney was using and all of the maps that they were referencing at NASA were actually lower res and more antiquated than what we have today.
Yep. Yes. Hmm. Or, but the same thing, yeah. That was weird. That was weird.
One thing that came up during the Andy Weir interview that he said he knew this was a gimme but just had to do it was radiation.
Yeah.
Mars has an insignificant local magnetic field, basically doesn't have a magnetic field like the Earth, plus the atmosphere, as we mentioned, 1/100th of an Earth atmosphere. So those cosmic rays would be bathing down on Mark Watney the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
And that, he would have vastly exceeded his lifetime, you know, radiation exposure that NASA allows astronauts to have. You know, he would have been at high risk for cancer. You know, that would have been the ending of the movie. But, in the book, Weir says, all right, he just invents this magic fabric. At some point, we come up with this material, this fabric-like material that filters out radiation. And so that made it all plausible. But, of course, we don't have that fabric today.
Yeah, that's true. He does reference it, though. It's not like he just ignores the
issue. No, he knew it. He knew it, and he...
There's a great quote of Mark Watney saying, with no magnetic field, Mars has no defense against harsh solar radiation. If I were exposed to it, I'd get so much cancer that cancer would have cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but, he definitely references it.
But here's one thing that you can't get out of, and that is he was growing the potatoes inside the HAB.
Oh, yeah.
And that had radiation shielding. So where was the sunlight coming from? You can't have sunlight, but no radiation.
I think he had grow lights. Did he not have grow lights?
I didn't see the grow lights.
Maybe he did
in the book, but didn't in there.
Okay.
Yeah, he definitely would have
grow
needed
lights. Would have been,
grow lights.
Would have needed grow lights, yeah.
Yeah, and it's that's not that hard to do.
Either grow lights or he would. You could have something like parabolic reflectors that concentrate the sunlight. That and then transmit it through fiber optics. That's another option. But yeah, one of those would be needed for sure.
And I love that just there's so many uses of low-tech things in a high-tech way. Like, that's a really common theme in the quotes throughout the book and the film, is like, you know, using trash bags, using duct tape, using something like, I can't remember what it was, but a geological containment unit, otherwise known as a box. Like, there's a lot of those kinds of references that I like. So it's like grow lights.
The radioisotope thermoelectric generators, they made a big thing about, oh, we got to bury them. They're very dangerous. They're really not dangerous. You don't have to bury them. The real danger with those is if you pulverize the fuel pellets and then breathe them in, that's not even if you had a hammer and just banged on it, you're not gonna do that. And burying it's actually silly because they do emit a good amount of heat. They would have them in the habs for keeping the habitat.
You really think so? They would have these sources of nuclear, like these intense sources of nuclear radiation.
Well, I mean, it's not your preferred, but if safety essentially is not that much of an issue.
Now, Bob, I read that the types of particles that they emit won't even go through your skin. You know, they're not dangerous. Oh. They're very low energy particles.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Yeah. Oh, in fact, so they said the radiation from Mars was way more than any whatever tiny little would be coming from there. I mean, if the radiation shielding was protecting him from Mars, it was protecting him from this. That was a non-issue.
Yeah, it was just a device to make it a little more dramatic.
Yeah.
The sunsets are blue. They're not red.
Yeah, that was wrong. But the moons were accurate. The moons were accurate.
The moons were good. The topography wasn't. One guy was saying on the IO9 website, he said that Acidalia Planitia is relatively flat, but it's nowhere near as gentle as portrayed in the story. Real quick, the botany was mostly right. They did a really good job with that. You can grow crops in Martian soil. Some things actually grew better in simulated Martian soil than Earth. Potatoes would be very good for you. I think the best in terms of calories.
Potatoes have pretty much everything you need nutritionally, but protein.
Protein. Yeah. Protein would be a problem. Also, the potatoes he used, they would not have sprouted because they almost certainly would have irradiated them.
Aww.
To kill any microorganisms.
Sterilized? That could be,
yeah.
So they would not have sprouted. Would not.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, you're right. Well, they would have irradiated them.
Did he have potatoes there to conduct growth experiments with, though?
No, Thanksgiving. They were Thanksgiving.
They made
a big point of that. They were Thanksgiving potatoes.
I don't know if that's true in the book. I can't remember. They may have been there for his botany experiments.
Let's say that they were.
Because that works.
Yeah.
Also, though, the truth is there's enough captured water in Martian soil that he wouldn't have had to go through all that trouble to hydrolyze the water.
Yeah.
Or to create, you know, to cleave the hydrazine.
We didn't know that 4 years ago, though.
Yeah, well, that's true. We didn't know it when he first started writing it. So that's we'll give him that one, too.
And we were pointed out in our interview that the hydrazine, burning that to make water, would have created so much heat it would have, like, melted the hab. But if he had known that, he would have created a way of venting the heat or whatever. There were solutions to that.
Right.
He didn't know it was a problem because he didn't do the calculations, but somebody did that for him.
Because how many calculations do you need to write a book?
All right, any other closing comments?
Loved it.
We're going to science the shit out of our podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to science the shit out of this. All right, let's move on. Jay, who's that noisy?
I played one of my favorites, one of my all-time favorites, from one of my all-time favorite sci-fi movies. I know you guys knew what it was from the beginning, so who wants to say what it was?
Come on, Dune. Weirding module.
Weirding module.
Yeah, so, yes.
Yeah.
Not so, Dune 2. Yeah.
Here's the sound. So what you're listening to is a weirding module, and what it does is it magnifies some words actually have a negative vibe to them that can kill and do destruction.
In the book, by the way, there was never any weirding module. It was all just a technique. The device was an invention of the movie solely. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. I forgot about that.
Yeah, wow. And so what they portrayed it as doing is just sort of magnifying just the sonic power of the vibrations in the voice and focusing it as a sonic weapon. But you had to know how to say the right word and have it resonate with the weirding module, whatever. But in the books, it was just you learned to do it just with your voice.
But one of my favorite moments in the movie and in the book is when Paul realizes that his name, Muad'Dib, is a killing word, right?
Yes.
Muad'Dib.
And just so I don't forget, Duncan Goodridge guessed that first. Good job, Duncan. He knew exactly what it was. A lot of people knew exactly what it was. A couple of people wrote in extraordinary detail, extraordinarily awesome detail about the book and the movie. You know, like Steve was saying,
it's a classic.
I thought that was great. I also received emails from people thanking me for playing one that was quote unquote kind of easy because they felt good being able to guess what it was. It was fun. All right, so this week's Who's That Noisy? I hope you guys guessed. I really do hope you guessed this one.
It's a blaster.
Want to hear it again?
Sounds Star Wars-y to me.
Ready?
Oh man, that's.
All I can say is, good luck. Tell me what that is. Be specific, at very least, to the film or TV show. But feel free to write in as much details as you like to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Just three regular news items this week. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Here we go. Item number one, using a mathematical model to predict crime location in order to direct police deployments resulted in a significant decrease in crime, even outperforming crime experts. Item number two, a new study indicates that the Earth's inner core of solid iron nickel formed between 1 and 1.5 billion years ago. And item number three, physicists have recently published a paper demonstrating that the precise measurement of time is fundamentally impossible. All right, Bob, go first.
All right, we've got a mathematical model that predicts the crime location in order to send the police to the right place. And that actually resulted in a decrease in crime. Now, see, you're not specifying why there was a decrease. I wonder if they actually advertised the fact that that they were doing this. I wonder if there's a psychological component to this. People thinking, oh man, this algorithm or whatever they used is going to predict that this is going to happen here. So I wonder if that could explain that. I'm sure there are things you could do certain times of day, certain locations in the city to say this is the greatest probability of crime. So sure, I mean, with such little information, it certainly sounds feasible. Let's see, the inner core of solid iron formed between 1 and 1 point. What? No way! Come on, a quarter of the age of the Earth is when we had the solid inner core. Oh man,
the Earth is only 10,000 years old.
I don't know about that one. Yeah, the fundamentally unable to precisely measure time. So, okay. Well, one thing that we covered on the show like a year ago was the idea that our time measurements are becoming so precise that your altitude, your distance from the center of the Earth actually needed to be taken into account. So, oh crap, but I wonder if that's even coming into play here. Could it be chaotic in a sense where you, like actually predicting weather? Well, that's more prediction than measurement. Well, the measurement's a big. All right, I'll stop. I can just go on and on. All right, I know I'm going to get nailed on this one, but the core, Jay.
She's tired.
Put your nickel down.
Yeah. Then I'll have to pick. I'll put my nickel down on the iron nickel being fiction. I mean, that just doesn't seem. That's 1 billion now. I don't think so.
Okay, Evan.
So this mathematical model to predict crime location resulted in a significant decrease in crime, even outperforming crime experts. This sounds like sabermetrics when it comes to baseball in a certain way. You just kind of use these mathematical models to put the best baseball team on the field. Yet, according to the experts of baseball, people who, know the players and can see other things in them, they argue against that. I'm not sure if the book is closed on that or if that's necessarily a really good analogy here, but that's kind of what my mind is drifting towards. I just can't get away from this whole sabermetrics thing, and it's gnawing. It's too sort of similar to that. So I think the crime location one's going to turn out to be the fiction. I don't think it outperforms the crime experts.
Okay, Jay.
this one about the predicting of the crimes could work simply because if you have enough data to build a model, then why wouldn't you be able to predict like the crime location? Yeah, there's neighborhoods that are more likely and all that, and there's times during the day when crimes typically happen more often than others. It seems like almost too simple. Like, yeah, do it. Use the data and figure out when and where, you know, crimes are going to happen. I think that makes a lot of sense. The second one, I know the Earth is a lot older than 1.5 billion years, so I would think that the Earth's core formed earlier in the life of the planet. So I just don't know how much, core geology was going on back then. This seems like that's kind of weird, so I see what everyone is saying about that. And the last one about the paper that demonstrates precise measurements of time is fundamentally impossible. I tend to agree with that because of gravity and speed and whatnot, there is, time is so variable and so changeable. Even, do I remember this correctly? But, if something is 100 feet above, one clock is 100 feet above another clock, there is going to be a time difference. So I get that. I agree with that third one. So I'm going to say that the second one about the Earth's core is the fiction.
And Kara.
Let's see. I'm going to go in the opposite direction. Physicists have recently published a paper demonstrating the precise measurement of time is fundamentally impossible. That one I buy. I think that's science because time itself is a concrete entity. Time exists, and this is a real phenomenon. But clocks are oftentimes relative. They're man-made. We've worked really hard to make amazing atomic clocks, but they are still, I think, tied to, as we were just discussing, to things like how fast something's going or how much mass it has. So I'm going to say that that is a fact. The study indicating that the Earth's inner core of solid iron nickel formed between 1 and 1.5 billion years ago. Somebody was just asking about geology. They were saying their kid had a question about geology today when I was at the eye doctor. And I think the idea that maybe there are actual dynamic things at work inside of the Earth is not the craziest idea. And it says formed. Formed, I think, is the operative word there. This one kind of bugs me. And then the other one, the mathematical model to predict crime location. I have actually heard of this. I haven't heard of any news articles about it recently, but it's called predictive policing. It's something that we've actually covered on a science show that I worked on. And I'm actually kind of nervous that it's one of those things where we dumped a lot of money into something that might not work, where the science might not be that solid. It's not just about where it happens. It's about a lot of other variables. And I wonder if trying to simplify it that much doesn't oversimplify it. So against my better judgment, I'm going to say that the predictive policing, the mathematical models one, is the fiction, and that somehow there's something geological happening in the core of the Earth that I don't understand. And that's fact.
Okay, so you guys are split between 1 and 2. So I guess we'll start with 3 and take these in reverse order. Physicists have recently published a paper demonstrating that the precise measurement of time is fundamentally impossible. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Ah!
What?
Wow.
Now, I know you're probably saying that you read this, and...
No.
He swept us.
Swept you again.
I feel like
Steve?
A particle of dust on the floor.
What just happened?
Let's start over again.
Wait. Redo.
All right, so there was a paper, and don't read the headlines. The headlines will mislead you. So that's kind of
that never. Happens.
If you read the headline and didn't read deep into the article, you might have thought this one was science. So what the paper showed. So first of all, there is something called proper time, and you should be able to measure it precisely. But what the physicists were exploring was: is there any frame in which you can't measure proper time? What their calculation showed is that, and this is actually, again, it's in principle, it's not the technology of clocks, right, it's just fundamentally like time itself is not regular. But
it's more of a concept.
What they were saying is that under extreme acceleration that you can't measure proper time.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So, and when I say extreme acceleration, billions of G's.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. So not like a spaceship.
No, not a spaceship. Under like, so this is just all hypothetical. If you were accelerating at billions and billions of G's, then you couldn't measure proper time in principle because it would not be regular.
Busted.
Yeah. So that's it. But the headlines leave out that little part, you know, about it only is true under billions of G's, under all other conditions other than these hypothetically extreme situation, you can measure proper time. There's no fundamental reason why you can't. At that point, it's just a matter of technology. But there's no physical reason why you can't measure time. So that one was the fiction. Okay, let's go number two. A new study indicates that the Earth's inner core of solid iron and nickel formed between 1 and 1.5 billion years ago.
Really?
Was it Jay and Bob thought this one was the fiction?
Yeah, yeah.
But this one is science.
Yep.
So the Earth has an inner core and an outer core. If you recall, the inner core is solid and the outer core is liquid. And the fluid outer core moves, you know, and that's what generates the magnetic field of the Earth, which is nice to have. We talked about also, Bob, and one of your superheroes of science, how they figured all this out. It's all with different waves propagating through the Earth, and some go through solids, and some go through fluids, and they were able to tell, you know, by how these waves propagate through the Earth, what the inside of the Earth is composed of. So this is what's happening at the transition zone between the outer fluid core and the inner solid core. The heavier metals are precipitating out and crystallizing into the solid. And that leaves behind the lighter elements. And that those lighter elements then will then float to the top of the fluid outer core. And that causes convection. And that's one of the dynamos that's driving the fluid outer core and generating our magnetic field. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know what temperature the inner core is?
Hot.
It's hot.
It's like the hotter than the surface of the sun.
It's about as hot as the surface of the sun.
That's insane.
It's a 5,000 C, 3,000 C, 5,000 C.
5,700 K.
Or
5,400 degrees C. Yeah, so that's hot. So why is it solid at that temperature?
The pressure.
Because of the pressure. Right. So at what point did the core of the Earth cool sufficiently that it would have become solid at the pressures on the inside of the Earth? The estimate has always been somewhere between 500 million and 2 billion years ago, and a new study showed that it's between 1 and 1.5. So it's narrowed the range a little bit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So prior to that, the core was fluid all the way. There was no solid inner core. It just hadn't cooled enough.
Okay, I guess that makes sense, yeah.
The core grows, the inner core, the solid inner core grows by about 1 millimeter per year.
Why? What the hell is that about?
Because it's continuing to cool. Because the inner core cools at about 100 degrees Celsius every billion years. So in a billion years, it'll be 5,300 degrees C rather than 5,400 degrees C.
Yeah. Not the name. People will be around to know that, but
right. And the inner core will be bigger.
And luckily, there's lots of radioactive decay going on, creating the heat. Otherwise, it would have cooled a long time ago.
Yes, to Lord Kelvin's eternal shame.
Yeah.
Yes,
I say.
But that's a story for another time. Let's go to number one. Using a mathematical model to predict crime location in order to direct police deployments resulted in a significant decrease in crime, even outperforming crime experts. Kara and Evan thought this one was a fiction, but this one is also science. Evan, I think your analogy to sabermetrics is spot on. It's using a mathematical algorithm to decide the behavior of essentially a complex system, whether it's winning baseball games or where crime is going to take place, rather than sort of the experience and gut feeling of experts. It's pretty much what it is.
Psycho history, Steve?
Well, I think it was what it reminded me of was the TV show Numbers. You guys ever watch that?
No, never.
Yes, never. One of the few shows I've actually seen several episodes of.
Yeah, I watched a season of it. It's a mathematician who would help his crime-fighting brother by using mathematical algorithms to this exact kind of thing. What the recent study showed, this has been going on for a while, but what the recent study did, they looked at, that's what it's called, Kara, predictive policing. They did a couple of studies. They had the algorithm choose one, basically like half a block in the city of Los Angeles, where they think would be at the highest risk of a crime being committed over the next 12 hours. And then they had experts decide what they thought was the most likely half a block. And then they sent police to both locations. The police didn't know if they were going to the one predicted by experts or by the computer. And the police were just told, just keep an eye on things and react as you would, as your training dictates you should. You know, they didn't tell them to do anything specific. Just keep an eye out for what happens. And the computer algorithm did about twice as good as the experts.
Wow.
But twice as good.
Twice as good, but the absolute numbers are pretty
good
modest.
Question.
The computer model predicted the locations of crimes 4.7% of the time.
You know, but it turns out, Steve, that the computer algorithm got drunk after work and robbed the 7-Eleven.
Yeah. It's all right. But the experts did 2.1% of the time.
Both were pathetic.
Yeah, but keep in mind, they're predicting a half a block. You know, they're in all of Los Angeles. It's less than 1%. Yeah. So they're outperforming by area like five times, you know, or more. So it's, you know, it's not horrible. And then in another version of it, where they sent police, I think, to more than one area, the model predicted the location 9.8% of the time, the analysts 6.8% of the time, so about 50% better. Yeah, so they outperformed in all the experiments that they did. The computer model outperformed the experts. And they said, even though these numbers may sound modest, again, just keep in mind that any additional predictive value that helps them send police to the right location, they estimated that even at this level, it would save the city $9 million a year.
Nice.
Wow.
Nice.
And lives. Yeah. And people's lives.
From
would
yeah, cost
too.
To victims and court costs in society.
Well worth it.
So, yeah. So that sounds. And they said that their algorithm learns. So it'll get better over time. Because you're just
it's like
constantly
it's,
feeding data back into it. So, you know, who knows? And again,
Minority Report here.
That was the other thing I thought of, is Minority Report. You know, you send police there ahead of time and it prevents the crimes from happening because you're standing there so the car doesn't get jacked or whatever. So, you know, it's not going to erase crime, obviously, but it might be another way to give a little bit of an edge to the police. This is a manifestation, I think it's fair to say, of big data, you know, using lots and lots of data
exactly,
and then having computers crunch it in order to figure out the behavior of complex systems or whatever. So very interesting.
And you could imagine in the future when there are data collection or, you know, surveillance skills are a lot better, they could, you know, make a surprisingly significant improvement. You know, if they can get it to like 20% or something crazy, how much would that save?
Or you like London. London has every street monitored with video, but that's, you know,
LA too. LA, almost every street corner is monitored with video.
Really?
New York's pretty monitored.
I went to basically the heart of LA traffic. This is insane. It's an aside, but it's insane. In the 80s, when they did the Olympics here in LA, they actually installed what they call traffic circles, which are these little metal way stations in every major intersection. And there's fiber, like hundreds of thousands of actual pieces of fiber cable running to the middle of LA in order for them to be able to monitor all of LA's traffic in real time and adjust their algorithms for the traffic lights. It's absolutely insane. Like, talk about big data. But I was gonna say, with regards to this predictive policing one being fact, even though it means I was wrong, which sucks, I'm happy that it was fact because we covered this on a TV show I work on. And I'm glad that it was not all for naught because it's a science show.
Good.
Cool.
Steve wins.
Good job, Steve. Sweep.
Wow, Steve.
Yeah, you're really killing us, man. This is a tough one. I just look for interesting items and let the chips fall where they may. Yeah.
So humble.
Yeah. So, Evan, you have a quote for us this week.
I do. Here we go. Don't be afraid to be curious. Don't be afraid to ask silly questions. Why is the sky blue? It turns out silly questions have profound and interesting answers. That, at its heart, is what science is all about. It's understanding nature and not being afraid to ask why. Spoken by Amy Mainzer, who is an astronomer. She specializes in astrophysical instrumentation and infrared astronomy, and you've probably seen her on many of your favorite science and astronomy shows. She's an excellent spokesperson for astronomy and science overall.
And she's NASA, isn't she?
Yes. Yeah. Research scientist working on different projects at NASA's JPL, including the Wide Field Yep, including the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE, the Near-Earth Object Camera, NEOCAM, and NEOWISE mission study, the NEOWISE mission to study asteroids and comets using the reactivated WISE satellite.
Love it. Cool. Dr. Mainzer, represent.
Thank you, Evan. That was a good quote.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
We'll get you next week, Steve.
All right. See you next week.
Well, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.